Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is Sufism, Mohammedan Mysticism. It is said that once a person approached a Sufi teacher and asked that, is there a kind of a longing within each human heart for mysticism? And instead of directly answering the question, this teacher, he replied that there is only one word we have in Sufism for this, and that is a very long word that is called Angur Uzum Inab Stafil. And of course the person didn't understand what it means, and then he went on to narrate the traditional story in Sufism, which says that there were four travelers. One of them was a Turk, another was a Persian, the third one was the Arab, the fourth was a Greek, and they were having only one piece of coin. Now, they were hungry at a certain point, and they all wanted to get something which they wanted with that one coin. And so, one of them said, I want Angur. The other said, I want Uzum. The third said, I want Inab. The fourth said, I want Stafil. Now, a linguist was passing by, and he said, don't worry, give me the coin. And then he went, and he bought, came with a bunch of grapes. And each one of them immediately said, oh, this is my Angur, this is my Inab, this is my Stafil. So, this is what we are told, that the travelers are the humanity. The Sufi is that linguist. And the first task of the Sufi is, although he knows that the grape, you know, it's like different religions, and each one thought that his religion is the thing. Or we have that longing within for something which keeps us incomplete, and we want that there's something that will make us complete, something which we are searching for, and which we want to see in that particular religion only. And then it's the, as it were, the task of the Sufi to show us that it is this very same thing. So the first task is to show the underlying unity behind or underneath each and every religion. But we are also told that the Sufi knows much more. He knows that you can squeeze this grape, take out the juice, process the juice, obtain wine. He knows the merits of the wine, but we are told that he is not going to overwhelm this new person of the world by talking the subtleties of the wine, etc. So he begins where the person is. And that is the beauty, we are told, of Sufism. That he starts from where he finds the individual, although he himself has already extracted the wine. And what is this wine? That is what is the essence of every religion, the esoteric side of every religion. And so if you have to define what is Sufism, they will say that Sufism is nothing but the essential aspect of every religion. The esoteric aspect, the hidden aspect of every religion is Sufism. So just like the Freemasons of old, they used to be found in almost every country, and depending upon the need of the people and the country they were in, they will readily study one day maybe Bible, another country they will go, they may be ready to study Quran or even the Upanishads, depending upon what was the scripture of that particular country. Same thing it is said about the Sufis, that they are ready to take up any book or take up any religion or take up any scripture and then show you what is the esoteric aspect of it. So the Sufi, it is said by various authors, a Sufi can be a lawyer, a Sufi can be a businessman, a Sufi can be a sweeper, a Sufi can be a teacher. It is a man who says that I can be in the world, but not of the world. I want to get rid of my hatred, avarice, illusion, hatred, all that. When he says that, he is just a beginner. We are reminded of what HPB says in Raja Yoga or Occultism. She says that a lay chela, he is a man of the world, who only affirms his desire to become wise in spiritual things. And in that sense, all those who are the students of Theosophy or Theosophical Society or ULT, you can say they are lay chelas in one sense. So this is what the Sufi begins, the step from where he begins, from wherever he is. But there is a big transition then to becoming a Sufi who is a mystic. And that is what we are going to see. Sufism as mysticism. And this transition, let us remember that the very characteristics of Sufism is that this transition is not going to be spanned. This gap is not going to be spanned merely by intellectual study. The emphasis is on actual experiencing. So they say that he who tastes knows. So it is actually experiencing it, not knowledge, but emphasis is more on wisdom. Now, we can see therefore that anybody can actually start walking this path of Sufism, and then he ends with becoming a Sufi mystic later. But, as we said, before we go any further, some of them have put Sufism to be as old as 2nd millennium BC. Some of them, they say that the more recent Sufism is between 8th and 18th century AD. But HPP solves this problem for us when in Isis and Vale, she, as it were, traces back the lineage, or rather the source of where exactly it stems from. And you understand, therefore, and look upon Sufism in a quite a different light. She starts with Plato, says, Plato states that the mystic Magian religion is the most uncorrupted form of worship in things divine. Later, the mysteries of Chaldean sanctuaries were added to it by one of the Zoroasters and the emperor Darius Hystaspes. The latter completed and perfected it still more with the help of the knowledge obtained by him from the learned ascetics of India, whose rites were identical with those of initiated Magi. Instructed by their teaching in the science of the motions of the world and of heavenly bodies and in pure religious rites, he transfused them into the creed of Magi. The latter, coupling these doctrines with their own peculiar science of foretelling the future, have handed down the whole through their descendants to the succeeding ages. It is from these descendants that the Sufis, chiefly composed of Persians and Syrians, acquired their proficient knowledge in astrology, medicine, esoteric doctrine of the ages. The Sufi doctrine, says C.W. King, involved the grand idea of one universal creed, something which we have already seen, one universal creed which could be secretly held under any profession of an outward faith. And in fact, took virtually the same view of the religious systems as that in which the ancient philosophers had regarded such matters. So this is how HPP puts it, not actually naming a particular date for the start of Sufism. Now, as we said, the Sufi would deal with the person as he found it, as it is said about HPP, that she dealt with the race mind as she found it. And that is exactly how a Sufi will deal with the people. So supposing the need of the people at that time is of a particular kind. Like, for example, the great master of Sufism, Jalaluddin Rumi, who was in Turkey, in Konya, and he found that the people were very phlegmatic there. Or if he found that people are given over totally to entertainment and frivolity, how do you teach them? You don't abandon them, as they always say that each man has got in him the truth, only it needs unfolding. So then we have this great order of dervishes. We have various orders in Sufism. There is the Kalandaris, and there are these dervishes, and there are others like Chishtis and so on and so forth. These are not like monastic orders of the Christians, but we are told that it is depending upon the master who was teaching, depending on the needs of the people then, that the order came into existence. So you have the order of dervishes, with which I think most of us are familiar. And that is something which was started by Jalaluddin Rumi. And it is this dervishes. And one of the things that he found in Turkey where he was, that he could start to teach them through music and dance. So there are these whirling dervishes. And we know the importance of music. HPP has a lot to say in Isis and Vale. But we are also told about how it can affect the inner being of man. If it is a very fast and a tom-tom drums and things like that, then it can produce a psychical frenzy. But if it is really a good music, it can bring about a different state of consciousness. Now, he used to combine this. Mind you, it requires a good guide and a teacher to have the reed music. Reed pipes were used for that music on one hand, and then choreograph these dancing in a particular rhythmic or sometimes even arrhythmic movements in such a way that a certain mystical currents are produced, and the person is brought under the influence of those mystical currents so that some sort of an inner transformation in the state of consciousness can take place. So this is how he used to use the music and the dance. Nothing much is available, of course. You have to go into details of seeing what this dervish dancing is all about. But this is one method. Another thing that the Sufis always felt was, you must start from where the individual is. So, in spite of the conditioning of the world, they felt that there is one aspect in man which is not completely crushed by the conditioning of the world. It may be a very mundane person. It may be a person who is totally given over to business and things like that. And yet there is something, and that is the love, which cannot be entirely killed out, even by the normal mundane activities and conditioning of your personality, of your worldly activities. And that's why we see that in all Sufi literature, in all Sufi poetries, you take Khalil Gibran, you take Umar Khayyam, you take any other, and you find that there's a great emphasis on love, of course. People have not been able to interpret it properly, that's another matter. But there is love which is emphasized, and we are told to make a beginning from there. Once again, you see, you can see a parallel here. In Voice of the Silence, if you see the seven virtues, what is the first one? Dana. The key of charity and love immortal, we are told. And we are also told that that is what immediately appeals to a person. You feel that, okay, that's something I can do. I cannot do, have detachment, I cannot have this. But love, yes, it's so simple to love other human beings. And then when you start practicing, you find that it's not so easy. As the Voice of the Silence itself says, that it's a gate which is so wide, it seems easy of access. It seems easy of access. You feel that it's very easy to love, but it's not. And that is what you find in various Sufi poems. They bring out this very aspect, that it's not easy to become a lover. Although Sufi, our Jalaluddin Rumi says again and again, whatever you are, wherever you are, try to be a lover. But we are also told by various Sufi poets that unless and until you have a heart of a lion, courage of a lion, don't try to walk the path of love. Now here we see that even if you don't now consider the various shades of love, simple human love, and you find that the minute you say that it has to be unconditional love, where you don't want the other person to change in any way, it is the love in which you are willing to change yourself. It is the love in which often all that you get is not pleasure but pain. As Khalil Gibran, in that everybody must have read Prophet, and on love he says, if you are only looking for pleasure, get up from the threshing floor of love. Love's floor, it could be a threshing floor. Actually, as you thrash out the chaff from the grain, that's the process through which you might have to pass, even in a simple human relationship, where you have to accept the person as he is, and therefore that will call for self-transcendence, self-effacement, really becoming a different individual. And so, that is what they felt. Another thing about love, they said, is that the more loving a person is, the greater will be his morality. Now we can see, this is something similar to what St. Paul also said. St. Paul said, love and do what you will. Now it's very simple. Love and do exactly what you feel like. But you know that if you really love people, not just one person, but in the true sense, if you love people, can you really go wrong? Do you really require a book to tell you, this is the virtue, this is how you must behave? Morality will then stem from the heart. So that is what they, that is why the emphasis is there on love. Of course, we will touch upon this topic once again when we go a little further into this aspect. Now, we talked about the dervish order. Of course, there are orders and orders, but if you take any one order, you get some idea of what this Sufism is about. Dervish order, they say that there are travelers and there are dwellers. Just like in Buddhism, you have, there are those who are supposed to be moving. There are wandering ascetics in the olden days, for which they said, charati charto bhaga. The one who moves, his fate also moves. They were the wandering scholars. So also among Sufis, there were dwellers and there were travelers. But traveling is also done with the intention of getting knowledge, following a particular program, a particular pattern, etc., etc. But there are dwellers. And many authors have compared this with the Varnashrama, or rather the four ashramas of Hinduism. There are the people of service, khidmat as they call. There are those people who are called as the people of society, and there are people of retirement. The people of service are the ones who are supposed to be in the first Brahmacharya ashram. The people of the second distinct society, they have to learn to remain in the society, pass on the knowledge, etc., and they would be coming close to what we call as the Grihastha ashram. And the people of retirement or solitude, they are supposed to be those who following the Vanaprastha or what we call as the even the Sannyasta ashram. Now, another important aspect of Sufism is regarding the concept of God. In fact, the whole idea of mysticism is that it's the one person who has realized his union with the divine. He has realized his oneness with that divinity. And so the concept of God is very much in line with what we can call as the Advaita philosophy. And they also agree, just as Theosophy, the Upanishads say, that you cannot get the idea of God by intellectualizing. You cannot get the idea of God by any kind of superficial logic. You can get the idea of God only through what they call as certitude. The word used is yakina, yakin, you know, that of course it's colloquially it is used in many other sense, but yakin is certitude. It is only through certitude that is a self-certifying experience, what the Shankara calls as aparokshanubhuti, experience not had through the eye of another. It's only then that manner that you know about the existence of God. Now, another important aspect, therefore, of Sufism is that the emphasis laid is not on intellectual understanding, but more on the wisdom aspect of it. That you have intellectual learning, you apply it. A Sufi will not say that therefore now I will read this book or read that book or try to understand it, but he will rather say that I will try to change myself in such a way that I can perceive this truth, whether it is the truth of God, whether it is the truth of law, that I will change myself internally and perceive it. So the inner transformation is what is really emphasized. And this is something very important because, again, if you see the Sufi literature from the 8th to the 18th century, you find that this aspect is emphasized in their teachings. Like, for example, it is said about the Punjab Sufi, a very well-known one, made even more popular through the songs of Abida Parvin, the Baba Bhule Shah. He was the one Sufi who, it is said that when he was a child, he was sent to school to learn his alphabet. And while his other children learned like this, in few days they completed mastering the alphabet, but this person was stuck at the first alphabet, Alif. And then the teacher said that, well, this is useless. No matter what I try, he's not going to go beyond that. The father had a personal private tutor for him, but to no avail. Finally, he saw the disappointment of the people around and he ran off to the forest. And there he suddenly saw this Alif everywhere, in the trees, in the streams, in the sun, in the moon, whatever he saw in nature, he saw Alif there. And then after a few years, he comes back to the original teacher and says, bows down to him and says, thank you teacher for teaching me my first lesson. I have learnt it now. Can you teach me more? And the teacher says that he recognized and he laughed. And he knew that this is the person who couldn't go beyond Alif. So what is he saying about learning? Then he said, now, whatever you say you have learned, write down on that wall. So this person wrote Alif there, whatever we call as A. And it is told that this Alif split into two on its own. And the teacher bowed down to him. Now, if we just use our own understanding, you see, what it is trying to say is a profound truth. The one becomes the two becomes the three, the four, the seven, as we are told in the secret doctrine in Theosophy, that it is that one which gives out the impulse with that self-energizing differentiation takes place and so the manifestation comes about. So nothing else is required. Self-impulsion is there from that one, the one becoming the two on its own. Teacher must have seen whatever he was trying to say. But that is what is there in one of our, this thing about Bhule Shah, which is on the second page of the quotations you have. He says, leave your learning aside. Fill not your room with tomes, that is volumes. You burden the mind with learning, cease, for it has no use. In pursuing the false, lose not the true. One alif is all you need to know. All you need to know is alif, that there is this one. Now, of course, this is, of course, the idea which is there about scorn for sheer learning, panditya, what we can call. Or that is what each great teacher would say, that don't stop at merely learning. You have to also try to realize it, practice it. And as regards God, there is this, since we are talking about God, there is this other quotation at the top of the second page, which is from Hasan Basra, another Sufi, who says, I asked a child walking with a candle, from where comes the light? Instantly he blew it out. Tell me where it has gone, then I will tell you where it came from. See, such a simple way of expressing something which we repeat every time in the first fundamental proposition by saying what God is, it is impermanent, beginningless, endless, this, that. This is what it is trying to say. It is beginningless. You don't know where it has come from. It is endless. You don't know where it is going. So, and also it is in a way trying to say that it is beyond words. What the Upanishad says, neti neti. Nobody is going to try and explain that the child, that is, sometimes this innocence of the child is compared with the really wise man. You know, innocent is the word used for the really wise man. Right? Wise men will not spend their time in arguing with you. They'll just give some cryptic thing like this and tell you that, look, it's useless to argue over these things. So, this is the concept of God. Then there's another important concept in Sufism, and that's regarding what they call as the different learning to differentiate between what they call as hakikat and hat and dat. Hakikat is what we can call as the relative truth, the relative reality, the objective or the external reality. That is hakikat. And that is dat. Dat is the essence. There is the essence of things. So they say that you can see a lamp and you know that, okay, it's of such and such a metal, it gives out light, it gives out heat. But supposing it is giving out some other kind of radiation, which is impalpable, which is imperceptible. It is having some other things. You go deeper and deeper till you come to the very essence, what Immanuel Kant said, the thing in itself. The thing in itself, can you really know the thing in itself by your five senses? No. So there is always that thing in itself or dhat or the essence. And that's why they always say that a man who really wants to know God, he, first of all, he should know his own essential self. He must know his own essential self, and only then he can really know the nature of God. Now, this is the same thing which is also applied to love, which we left off earlier. We can come back to that whole idea of love, because it is something which is so stressed in each and every poet's scripture, or rather the stories, that we must get the correct idea of it. They differentiate between what is known as the ordinary love and what is the special love. The ordinary love, they say, is this love, love of hakikat, what you see externally. It could be love of beauty of the form. You see, that's what you see today, mostly. Love of the beauty of the form. And there is nothing wrong in that, because again, if you go back to Plato, he always said that this beauty which you admire, and your soul feels so thrilled when he sees the beauty in the external form, in a way, it is a reflection of the beauty which is on a higher plane. And that is why he says, Euclid alone saw beauty bare. Euclid alone saw beauty bare. That it was only Euclid who could see beauty in its highest state, in those geometrical forms, in those divine proportions. We must read this Da Vinci Code, which is there. One of the chapters there is talking about these divine proportions. That there is proportions everywhere. There is divine proportions in the entire universe as it is. So that sort of a beauty we have to see. And then essentially, then you come to the very essence that you see in everything. And that very essence is that divine aspect in everything. And that is why in loving an individual also, you slowly progress from that beauty of the form to the maybe the beauty of the temperament, beauty of the emotion, coming finally to the beauty of that very essence. What the Upanishads say, and which is often quoted from this platform, Atmanam Sarvam Priyam Bhavatu, that it is the Atman because of which everything becomes so dear to you. It is not the wife is not dear because she is your wife, but wife is dear because there is that self shining in that wife. Of course, we have not come to that state, but that's what actually every Sufi poet is trying to tell you. And the other aspect, stretched to its limit, is that in that love, sometimes we are lost in the real love. And some of people like Emerson have said, what is a friend but a single soul dwelling in two bodies? Or maybe the two lovers may say that for each other. But that, in a way, is something which we have to realize in a higher sense. That is, that my soul or the divine in me is not different from that one reality. So long as you try to understand God as Him being there and you being here, self-knowledge will never come. The true knowledge of the God is you lose yourself. That mine and thine, I am here, you are there, must go. And that's what that thing which we have quoted from Jalaluddin Rumi, which is so very famous, is here. It says, a man went to the door of the beloved and knocked. A voice asked, who is there? He answered, it is I. The voice said, there is no room for me and thee. The door was shut. After a year of solitude, deprivation, he returned and knocked again. Now, a voice from within asked, who is there? The man said, it is thee. The door was opened for him. Now, so this thing, in whatever relation it is, here and then slowly you transcend and come to that relation with God, when that I and thee, that even that little curtain of proscenium, as they say, it, even that is gone, only then you can really actualize and feel the presence of God within you. Now, another important aspect which is there in Sufism, which is slightly technical, that is about the activation of centers. Now, activation of centers. This is what they call as Latifa. Latifa is simply meaning place of illumination. And Latif or Latif, that is the plural of Latifa, is centers. Now, this is something similar to what the other similar esoteric traditions speak about, and that is activating your different chakras in the body. Now, here we are not saying that Sufism is only concerned with the activating the chakras and all that, but we are trying to show that they are very, very cautious, because they say that it's a discipline where this must come much, much later. Unless and until there is inner preparation, you should not be in a hurry for activation of these Latifa, or what we call as the chakras in the body. And they even caution that you will end up being a false prophet. You will end up degenerating your consciousness. You will just be puffed up by the powers that you have as a result of activating these centers and chakras. And that is why people like Rumi and others have again and again emphasized that after a while, a need arises when you must have a guru. You must have a guru in order to carry on the further journey once you have arrived somewhere. Now, theosophical students are all aware of Raja Yoga or occultism, where in the first four chapters we are given sufficiently the whole background of what is Chelaship, what is Mahatmaship, what are the adepts, and so on and so forth. But it's very nice to find that the same idea is there in Sufism, where they say that the first, when the candidate approaches a Sufi teacher, he is given test to see first whether he is suitable to undertake such a thing which is finally going to lead him to becoming a mystic, and secondly, to find out what is the motive with which he is starting on the path of Sufism. So if it is found that even a subtle motive of acquiring powers is there, he would be rejected. He will not be allowed, or he will not be interested in instructing such a pupil. Second important thing that is being said about this pupil-teacher relationship, which is also there in our letters that have helped me in Raja Yoga or occultism, that you have to have complete confidence. Once that a teacher accepts you and that you acknowledge him as your guru, then no matter how that guru is, you have to completely devote yourself to the system which is taught by that guru. If there is doubt, if there is vacillation, if there is questioning, if there is, you will not be able to make progress. And also realize that teacher will be guiding your transformation, and that transformation is going to be bit by bit. Why we talked about the awakening of the centers is that at every point this is to be remembered, that unless there is a proper guidance and unless there is infinite patience in the pupil, to go through slowly, bit by bit, he can land up into trouble. And this is what is brought out very well in that very famous romance of what is called as Laila and Majnu. We are so told that there is the Majnu, literally meaning madman. And Laila is supposed to be a very beautiful woman. And they are belonging to two different tribes. Now Majnu just wants to see the beauty of this Laila. He says that, I want to be illuminated by her beauty and so on. He is absolutely obsessed, we can say. Now, the people of Laila's tribe say that there is no harm. But tell Majnu, does he have the power to withstand the beauty, the luster of when he sees the beauty of Laila? And yet, he wants to see. So what they do is, they just lift the fold of the tent in which Laila is sitting. And he is just able to glance at the fold of the skirt that Laila is wearing. He falls unconscious there. This may sound like one of the crazy tales of romance, but it's not so. By this, what we are being told is, deserve before you desire intimacy with the masters. You see? Unless and until you are prepared, if you just rush in like this, the Majnu wanting and wanting to see Laila, even when he was cautioned that, have you got the inward preparation which is required for seeing that? So many disciples are there, especially in the theosophic literature, we are told that you first prepare yourself. We are also cautioned, don't rush into the psychic realm. It's like a South American forest. You will not know, you will not be able to handle the forces. You, when you come in the presence of the masters, there are great forces playing around him and you can be thrown off balance. There must be something in your nature which may come to the surface. Will you be able to handle it? But people are like Majnu. They are madmen. They just want to go. We are told, don't rush into the circle of ascetics. Don't go where angels fear to tread. So, very profound truths, but they are put in such forms. Another important thing they say is that the duty of a teacher is also to block what they call as fill up the grooves in the mind of the disciple. That is, they tell the disciple that don't think in a fixed pattern. Don't think that this is the cause, so this is going to be the effect. Don't have a fixed viewpoint of things. Again, there are various names of the Sufi teachers, and one of the lesser known, or in a way to some, it is a very well known Sufi teacher, who is the Mullah Nasruddin. There are various ways of teaching. They will have myths, they will have fables, there will be legends, and there will be, of course, poetry, sculpture, painting, dances. But one of the methods is also through anecdotes. Now, this is a particular Sufi whose writings are full of humor. In fact, one should read them because it is called The Subtleties of Mullah Nasruddin. There is such a subtle advice, but given in such a light-hearted manner. So, for example, when he is telling his disciples, what we would say, that don't try to understand the intricacies of karma. Don't say that this is the cause or this is the effect. At your level, you will not be able to solve that. So the Sufis say, don't always think that there will have to be a fire because there is a smoke. There may not be a fire. Now how? This is how he says. He says, look, once I was passing by and a man from the roof just fell down. And finally, I was hospitalized because I had a broken neck. And he said, what have you learned? Well, he says, what you have learnt is that it is not necessary that when a man falls down from the roof, it will be he who will break his neck. See, he fell down and I broke my neck. So this is a very simple thing, but you have to use your mind to see that the cause-effect relationship, you know, the simple linkages we try to make in life, it's not so simple. Now, that is Mullah Nasruddin. But getting back to the whole idea of discipleship, etc., you find that such a profound truth of what the disciple has to go through, various tests and trials, is again put by certain other authors. And one of them, the student has not read, but now the student is induced to read that particular book, and that is the book by Fariduddin Attar. Fariduddin Attar has written a very long tale, which is a very mystical one, and it is called the Parliament of Birds. It is called the Parliament of Birds. Birds represent humanity. And there is a leader of the birds. He is called Hoopoe. Now this Hoopoe is telling these birds that you all go on a quest. You are supposed to find a mysterious king and his name is Simurgh. Unfortunately, we did not bring the references, but students are invited to go back to Secret Doctrine and see what HPB has to say about Simurgh. She has something definite, but we have forgotten what it is. There is a Simurgh that is the mysterious bird which you are supposed to find. And the birds, the humanity being what it is, first they are all excited because it's a new adventure. So they say that yes, yes, we will all each individually try to do it. And then slowly and gradually they all begin to fizzle out. Everybody is giving the reason that they are satisfied with what they have. And then this Hoopoe, the bird, the leader, who is supposed to represent the Sufi, says that look, you don't have to like what you have, nor also try to project in the future and say that this and this can happen to me in future from where I am. So I'm satisfied with my present and with my future, but you should be always induced to do what you should have or what you should do. So this is a very different thing, that the spiritual path that we are trying to follow, and this is where our reading comes to help, where we did not of course read that part, but it is the commentary, further commentary on what we were reading on page 17, where it is said that humanity left to itself will always have a very self-seeking attitude in walking the spiritual path. What is in that for me? How I will progress? What about the future? And see, either they will be just jumping madly or saying, no, no, I am happy with where I am. But see what the light on the path says. It says, is it the way you desire? Is it the way you desire? Or is it that there is a dim perspective in your visions of great heights to be scaled by yourself, of a great future for you to compass? Be warned, the way is to be sought for its own sake, not with regard to your feet that shall tread it. No matter what is there in store for you, it is the way which should be desired. And so finally, it is said that the birds, they go on a quest, and then the valleys that they have to pass. Interestingly, they have to pass 7 valleys. The first valley is the valley of love. Once again, it is that simple attachments which we have, which the Gita says you have to go about, the self-identifying attachment with wife, children, household, etc. Or what the Buddha says, it's not the fetters made of iron which are very difficult to break. It is these gems and precious stones, it is these wife and children, they make greater fetters and which we are not able to break and go ahead. The other valley is the valley of intuitive knowledge. The third valley, they say, is the valley of detachment. Now here something very important comes. It's not just detachment, which is again, one is tempted to compare all these things with the 7 paramitas. Love, dana, and then not exactly fitting, but value of detachment, vairagya, which is the very central thing. Now here again, some of them have said that there is a dialogue between the nightingale and the rose. And each one is saying that we are happy with the love for each other, the nightingale for the rose and the rose for the nightingale and so on. So we are happy with our simple, loving human relationship. But the author says that it works at both levels. One, even in spite of experiencing frequently incomplete love, we are not waking up. It should bring about a transformation in our inner being. It should alter our being and put us on a quest for a higher kind of love. It doesn't happen. So also there should not be attachment on the part of a person who has reached very great height. He may have reached heights where he has got certain powers. He has maybe reached second stage of samadhi. He has experienced certain rapture. He has certain visions. It is very easy to get attached even to that particular stage of your progress. So you have to go beyond even that rapture. People get bogged down by that. So even that detachment is required. Then of course he goes through the valley of what is called as unification, where he sees everything as one. The ideals, the religions, the humanity, the one underlying thing behind that. Valley of astonishment, where he is astonished because now he has a different look. You see, as you rise higher in your consciousness, the very things which you looked as an ordinary man in one way, now you are astonished to see that is this the thing for which I was crying, or is this the thing for which whatever. So you look things, your perspective on life changes. The valley of astonishment. And then there is a valley of death, which is what they call as the reaching the state of moksha, samadhi, or where you say the dew drop slips into ocean. And yet the dewdrop finds that it is not annihilated. People have wrong idea of samadhi or nirvana, where they feel that it is annihilation. But no, there is being and merging into the ocean, and yet a person comes out of samadhi. So a certain kind of individuality is retained. Now all this is in a way put, shall we say, in the Sufic terms, by saying that a person who has to become a Sufi mystic, there is a transition from what they call as jismani amul. Jisma is body. Jisma is body and therefore the outward thing. So jismani amul is observational practices, ritual, ceremony, prayer, pilgrimage. From jismani amul, you have to turn to ruhani amul. Ruha is spirit or soul. And ruhani amul is spiritual worship. There is what Vita says, mental devotion. So slowly and gradually, it is this contemplation, meditation, that's what is emphasized there, turning within for guidance rather than outside. So this is the transition which takes place through four steps. There is what is called as the Shariat. Shariat is a canonical law, usual religious injunctions. Your diligence says do this, do that, and that's like a ship. Then there is Tariqat, that is a way or the path, it's like the ocean. Then you come to Hakikat, which we saw, relative truth. And the last you come to Marifut, which is known as the final absolute truth, which they also call as Vasil, unification, being one, uniting with the one divinity, and so on. Now, we see that we have not made any mention of metaphysics. It's not as if they don't mention metaphysics, but in a small lecture like this, we did not want to bring in such a higher aspect of metaphysics, but it's there. There is a secret language, there is a secret book, there is a whole explanation given on alchemy, which we know it is a terrestrial alchemy and there is a spiritual alchemy. But there is some hint given as to following the symbology, that you are lost if you will not follow the symbology which is there in the Sufi, even whatever exoteric literature is there. Like for example, things like love and wine. If you, even dancing, even music, we know that there are mysteries of initiation. A mystic is one who is initiated. And therefore, in the mysteries of initiation, sometimes you find that there are the Bacchic mysteries, there are, mention is made of certain similar mysteries like that, Dionysian mysteries. What happens when the people don't understand the real meaning of this wine, of dance? There are only sexual orgies. There is frenzied dancing. And nothing, the original meaning is lost. So, in one of the Sufis, his name is Hujwiri, he has given two examples. The patched robe which the Sufis wear, it's a patch. You take patches and then you sew those different patches to make a robe out of it. Now, this of course, externally it means that they are decided to live in poverty. They have decided that they are going to struggle because it requires perseverance to make a robe by just putting together the patches. But this is only external meaning of the patched robe, the patched mantle. There is an inner meaning. And here we find, as HPB says, that for every symbol, for every word, there are so many meanings. This is a very simple example of what we know we are talking about as a secret language and symbolism. He says the word is raka for patch. And we will recall from Bible where Jesus says, he who calls his brother a raka, fool, is in a danger of hellfire. So seven different meanings are given. Raka, that is the patch which is reminding the Sufi that if you try to be puffed up about and feel holier than others, you will appear like a fool in the eyes of the people. Then it means a chessboard. And we are told that the secret meeting places of dervishes, the floor used to be like a chessboard with a white and black pattern. Then it is being addicted to wine. And that refers to one of the mystical experiences that a Sufi can have. It means repairing the well. And that means a Sufi's, as it were, function is to rectify the human knowledge. Now and then, it tends to get, as it were, effaced. It tends to get all muddled up, as Krishna says, I incarnate again and again. So it is Sufi's work to rectify this. And so one of the meanings of this patch robe is even that. Another thing is about the wine. And I think we will not have much time, but it's absolutely marvelous. If you just go to wine, and we will not be able to sufficiently elaborate, Let us not think that when they are shown as drinking wine and talking about intoxication, it's actually invitation to getting intoxicated. What happens during intoxication, as some of the authors explain? Your intellectual faculties are dulled, and that's what a Sufi is looking for. We are told that if you want to have experiences in the higher realm, you cannot be having your intellectual mind and even the brain activities. They will prove to be a hindrance. In the seership, the explanation given by HPB in Isis Unveiled, she points out the difference between a psychic clairvoyant and a seer, and says that for a psychic clairvoyant, the perception is not clear because there is hindrance coming from memory, fancy, and even the mechanical functioning of the brain. But a true seer who sees the truth as it is, he has been able to subject with his spiritual will the working of memory, fancy, and even the mechanical functioning of the brain. So this complete subduing, what she calls as when the physical is paralyzed, the spiritual can manifest. And also another reference to this occurs to the student's mind is, if you look up manticism in Isis Unveiled, in the first pages when she's explaining things, she is talking about the origin of mantic frenzy, and there she's bringing out that the root of manticism can be traced to manti in Sanskrit, meaning stirring up. And she mentions